Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. A judge overturned Governor Ron DeSantis' ban on school mask mandates. Leading GOP consultants are linked to Florida's ghost candidate scandal. And another prominent Democrat is weighing jumping into the Florida governor's race. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson. And those are some of the stories I'll be discussing today with Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy and Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. But first, music means it's number time, gentlemen. You have some numbers today. John, how about you?
Yeah, Zach, I'm breaking the bank this week with my number. It's a whopping $4 billion.
Wow. All right. How about you, Antonio?
Well, geez, I guess I'm going to go with just 78.
All right. And I'm in the middle again with 14,886. Remember those numbers, folks. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, last week, a judge in Leon County ruled that local school districts can impose mask mandates, invalidating an executive order issued by Governor Ron DeSantis that banned school mask requirements. Even before the court ruling, nearly a dozen school districts had ignored the governor and implemented mask mandates. Since then, more have followed, including the school district in conservative Lee County. John, what does this legal setback mean for DeSantis and his pandemic policies?
Well, the governor and education commissioner Richard Corcoran are really trying to keep this no mask mandate alive, even after he suffered the setback in the courts. And also what we're seeing in counties where you're seeing more join in the mandate. Although the judge's ruling that threw out the governor's mask mandate order, it basically said that he could not punish counties. The issue is that the judge's order has not yet been written and filed. And in a somewhat strange hearing, the judge a week ago spent more than 2 hours laying out what his decision was and then said that the formal written order was to be issued in coming days. In the meantime, Corcoran went ahead and said he was demanding that salaries be withheld from school board members in Alachua and Broward counties, which were some of the first defiant counties. And as more counties defy the governor and go ahead with mandatory masks now in schools, the state has been sending letters to school boards saying that they'll be next to lose their pay. The governor and education commissioner's ruling, it really breaks most political norms, which is not surprising for DeSantis, I guess, given his track record so far as governor. The judge has spoken, but DeSantis is basically betting that he's going to win this case on appeal when it goes to the First District Court of Appeal in Tallahassee, where the judges who will review the lower court's ruling are all appointed by Republican governors and tend to side with the Republican-controlled state government in most instances that go before them. There's separation of powers, of course, but when you get courts that are created by the elected officials, you get rulings that parallel the administration's thinking a lot of times. And DeSantis clearly thinks that he's going to win before the first DCA, and then if he goes from there, he'll win at the Florida Supreme Court level if it becomes a challenge to that body, because once again, the Florida Supreme Court is all Republican governor appointed. The lower court judge in this case, Leon County's John Cooper, he was pretty stinging, though, in his assessment of DeSantis. He said that the governor had overreached his authority, misrepresented state law, and ignored scientific evidence in issuing his order that prohibited schools from requiring masking of students and teachers and staff. But, DeSantis doesn't seem to care about this assessment of his pandemic policy. He's ridiculed the lower court, pointing out that another Leon County judge had thrown out his order last year to reopen schools, only to have it overturned by that same first DCA. So that gives DeSantis even more confidence that it's going to happen again. But, even as school cases are climbing and everyone is dealing with quarantines and child hospitalizations, and we've even seen this week, rural Taylor County and Gulf County, they had to cancel school for 2 days to allow for a reset because so many teachers were out either with COVID or home taking care of their own children that have been quarantined. So there's DeSantis. He's soldiering on, saying that he's right, that parents have the right to decide whether their child should wear a mask. And the governor still clings to that personal choice mantra. You know, the The thing, of course, with this pandemic is that COVID is it affects other people. So that personal choice is not always that personal.
Antonio, you know, John mentioned that the governor's education secretary, Richard Corcoran, is moving forward with punishing school districts that have implemented mask mandates, trying to strip funding away from some of the school board members who voted for this. Some people might scratch their heads at that. How can you punish people if the court has ruled against you? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, we should also note that Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody has gotten involved as well. The reports are that she sent an advisory opinion to Suwannee County School District that districts must comply with Department of Health COVID protocol rules, including, you know, a requirement that parents be able to opt out of wearing a face mask and, you know, the kids and until a court declares the rules are invalid. So, you know, this it seems that others are jumping in. But look, no one should be surprised to see the fight escalating this week. And I think for two reasons. One is what John just talked about, that DeSantis figured that, you know, if he lost with losing the initial court fight, he could, you know, sort of blame it on this liberal judge or whatever, or make fun of this judge and then appeal to more conservative and perhaps friendlier judicial panels. Second is something I said last week. The worst thing DeSantis can do right now is to look weak or defeated before his base, which is still very much Trump's base. So he couldn't take the kickoff loss in this legal fight and not respond. Now, that being said, just because he is moving forward with punishing school districts doesn't mean he has the upper hand. The Biden Education Department has said it would step in and fund local school districts that get penalized by DeSantis. And this week, Congresswoman Lois Frankel, a West Palm Beach Democrat, said it was time for Education Secretary Miguel Cardona to make good on that pledge. And in all this, as you know, more than half of Florida's K-12 public school students are attending classrooms in districts that are continuing to defy DeSantis, including the largest in the state, Miami-Dade. John also mentioned some of the other school districts, but you know, officials in Miami-Dade and also in Palm Beach County are sticking with, you know, their mask mandates. And in fact, Palm Beach County is looking to hire a top legal eagle to fight the governor in the courts. And then where you and John are, both Sarasota and Leon County school officials are not backing down either. So ultimately, DeSantis may have to take legal action against a slew of school districts. Now, interestingly, last night, Palm Beach County Superintendent Mike Burke said that the district's order doesn't violate state rules because the Florida Department of Health emergency rules have, quote unquote, directed schools to ensure safety protocols for controlling the spread of COVID-19. As long as they don't, you know, violate, you know, residents' constitutional freedoms, Bill of Rights under state law, and, you know, and promise to protect students with disabilities or health conditions. So, you know, there's another answer to this saying, hey, we're not violating state law. Look, your own Department of Health has said as much. So we'll see. But, you know, look, DeSantis has two paths to victory here. First, he wins the court fight, as John said, or second, you know, school districts cave in because for some reason the feds don't come through and the penalties take a financial toll. Although I've heard a lot of people saying, nah, that's going to be a while before that comes up. So either way, look, it makes political sense in courting the hard right political base and for the sake of leverage for DeSantis to keep increasing the pressure on the rebelling school districts. But, you know, as long as COVID cases are rising and more students are being sent home because they are sick or because they are COVID positive or have been exposed to someone with the virus, the school districts will feel the need to pursue their mask mandates and whatever they need to do to keep, you know, to keep COVID, you know, at bay here. You John talked about those two school districts that had to cancel classes. I mean, I'm sure none of the large school districts want to do that. And at the end of the day, all politics is local and school district politics are about the local community. And right now, you know, that is what's happening. So this standoff between the governor and the largest school districts and others will go into another week for sure.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like either side is going to back down anytime soon here. Well, another big story that we've been following that had some new developments this week was the ghost candidate scandal involving some third-party candidates in state Senate races in various parts of the state. Details of a scheme to run these ghost candidates to siphon votes away from the Democrats continue to drip out. The latest revelation is that a trio of leading GOP consultants were paid to work on the scheme, with the money coming out of $550,000 that was paid by two political committees to a direct mail company, which then distributed some of the cash to the consultants in a way that wasn't publicly transparent, but was later revealed by the mail company owner in court. The GOP operatives are Ryan Smith, Ryan Tyson, and Alex Alvarado. Smith once worked for the Republican Party of Florida, and Tyson is well known as the former chief political strategist for Associated Industries of Florida, which is a really big business lobbying group that has enormous influence in Tallahassee. Antonio, this case keeps getting closer to the Republican political establishment.
Yeah, not only that, but this scheme just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Look, when I was a college freelance reporter covering a state house race many years ago, I came across a ghost candidate. It's one of the first that I've come across. But I can tell you that effort was far from as elaborate or well-funded as this one. I mean, look, you just said it. The latest twist in this case is these three Republican consultants, you know, were paid for working this game with, you know, the money coming out of this $550,000. Wow. I mean, geez. And that's just one piece of the money trail here. You know, I keep thinking that with that kind of money, you know, these three so-called ghost candidates should have mounted at least some kind of half-hearted campaign, you know, maybe have gone to a candidate forum or done a couple of interviews. If they had done at least that much, all of this probably wouldn't have surfaced. But now it has blown up. And voting rights activists, advocates told me this week that the scandal rips open what they said is the lie behind this spring's, you know, election reforms in Florida. In that legislation, commonly known as Senate Bill 90, lawmakers and the governor put serious restrictions on the use of drop boxes and, you know, voter registration efforts, as well as mail-in voting. And why? Well, the governor and the Republican majorities in Tallahassee said it was to prevent fraud. But of course, there was no fraud last year in Florida. You know, in fact, Florida had the cleanest election in decades. What we did have, and this case points to it, was deceitful manipulation to fool voters. And in the Miami-Dade Senate race, in particular, perhaps, you know, criminal actions. As I said last week, you know, one of the ghost candidate in that race admitted his role and is going to serve 3 years of probation, including a year of house arrest. And the thing of the sad thing about it is, in Miami-Dade Senate race 37, the scheme seems to have worked. The ghost candidate that shared the same last name as the Democratic incumbent in that race got more than 6,000 votes. And that is one reason people say that the Republican candidate, now State Senator Ileana Garcia, was able to win by just 32 votes. So as one voter rights advocate told me this week, the only sham bigger than the ghost candidate was the selling of voter restrictions to stop phantom fraud claims.
And it's interesting to look at these races where they ran ghost candidates. There was a analysis that came out this week that kind of looked at state Senate and House seats that Trump had carried versus Biden carrying. And the two state Senate seats that Biden carried that are held by Republicans were the two where they ran these ghost candidates. So there was definitely, you know, these were no sure things for the GOP. And it seems like there was a lot of concern over whether Democrats had an advantage in these seats. Well, another prominent Florida Democrat is considering a bid for governor. State Senator Annette Tadeo told the Miami Herald this week that she is seriously contemplating getting into the race. Tadeo is a Latino lawmaker from the Miami area, a critical region for Florida Democrats. John Trump, he really expanded his margin of victory in Florida last year by dramatically improving his performance with Hispanic voters in Miami-Dade County. If Democrats don't reverse that trend, they're probably toast in next year's midterm elections. Tadeo's making the argument that a Hispanic lawmaker like her from Miami-Dade could give Democrats the best chance of sort of winning back a big margin in Miami-Dade and taking out DeSantis. What do you think?
Well, Tadeo may be the best Democrat in Miami-Dade. And, you know, if she does run, maybe we'll get to see how she does elsewhere. But her candidacy is kind of rooted in what you pointed out, that Democrats across the state are worried about what they saw in last fall's presidential election, when Democrat Joe Biden won Miami-Dade by only 7 percentage points compared to Hillary Clinton 4 years earlier. She won by 29%. So, you know, that's considered a real key part of Donald Trump's overwhelming win in Florida. Now, it's likely since then things have gotten worse for Democrats in Miami-Dade after criticism of President Biden over his mostly lack of response to citizens rising up in the streets of Havana, calling for freedom from the communist leadership there. You know, Tadeo, who is Colombian born, she was kind of prominent and critical of Biden, saying that this was his, she called it a quote, Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall moment for Biden, kind of recalling President Reagan's famous statement in Berlin from decades earlier. Now, you know, I've talked to some people pretty close to Tadeo, and I think she gets in the race. But it may be driven more by the lackluster fundraising of Democrats, Charlie Crist and Nikki Fried, the two announced candidates that are challenging DeSantis. And also what you're hearing is that South Florida labor organizations also are expressing uneasiness about the way the Democrats' campaigns have been going. You know, Tadeo has run statewide before as Charlie Crist's running mate during his unsuccessful campaign to deny then Governor Rick Scott a second term in 2014. So she was Crist's lieutenant governor candidate. So that's a little bit of an awkwardism there for the Tadeo Crist relationship now. But you know whether Tadeo will do much better than those already in the field, it's kind of hard to say. But you know, maybe she wins Miami-Dade. Democrats, though, have a host of problems right now. In fundraising, they're getting clobbered by DeSantis, who last month was raising money in Wisconsin, Michigan, New Jersey, and he's sitting on about $53 million in his Friends of Ron DeSantis campaign. And Crist and Fried, by contrast, they've raised combined $3.8 million. So 53 against 3.8 million is a chilling contrast for Democrats. And then, you know, you got to look too at the get out the vote effort. That's going to be a question mark for Democrats going forward. Out of 14.4 million registered voters in Florida, the Democrats now hold a lead of only 54,000 votes over Republicans. It was more than 300,000 more Democrats as recently as the 2016 presidential election when Trump was elected. And Democrats, you know, have held a lead in voter registration in Florida for the entire modern history of the state. But that looks like it's soon to end. It's almost guaranteed that it's going to disappear in coming months before a Democrat even makes it to the ballot to face DeSantis. So, you know, all told, the answer isn't easy for next year. DeSantis is strong. He's polarizing, but he has satisfied a rabid conservative base and has money flowing in nationally from people who think he could be the Republican presidential nominee in 3 years. So a lot of people are betting on him already. And, you know, the other factor is next year is a presidential midterm election when the party in the White House, the Democrats right now, they historically do poorly in elections across the board. So that's another uphill factor for Tadeo, Crist, or Fried, whoever gets the nomination for governor. There's some hope that they think the top of the ticket will be led by, it sure looks like, Val Demings, a Black Democratic congresswoman from the Orlando area who is one of the Trump impeachment managers. There's a thought that she is going to drive Democratic voter strength in the state during the election. The governor's candidate could be helped by that coattail. But, you know, these are all the unknowns of next year's campaign. And you're also going to have political redistricting next year for Democrats, which is going to be difficult in a Republican legislature. And that's going to change the shape of a lot of legislative and congressional districts and have a lot of candidates entering late into campaigns.
What do you think of what it says about the strength of the Democratic field that Tadeo, you know, is interested in jumping in? She obviously isn't scared off by Charlie Crist or Nikki Fried. And what do you think of her argument? I mean, you know, isn't it true that Miami-Dade is like a Democratic stronghold? It's something that it's a county that Hillary Clinton won by, I want to say more than 20 points. I mean, it should be. Yeah. I mean, if the Democrats don't do well in Miami-Dade, they have absolutely no chance. Right. I mean, Tadeo, she was sounding the alarm before the 2020 election about how Democrats were struggling in Miami-Dade. They were struggling to counteract the Republicans' message with Hispanic voters, where there was a lot of targeting of Hispanic voters with the messages about socialism and this idea that Democrats were wanted to expand socialism, and also some messages about the police and Democrats wanting to defund the police. She seemed to be more in touch with the problems that Democrats had in Miami-Dade leading up to the 2020 election. I don't know if she would be able to solve them, but as a Latina lawmaker, as somebody who is Hispanic, it seems like she could probably message better to the Hispanic community than other candidates. What do you think?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, that's very true. And of course, the Hispanic base for Democrats goes beyond Miami-Dade as well. You have, Osceola County is a huge bastion of the Orlando area with Hispanic voters. And again, there are certain bedrock areas that Democrats need, phenomenal turnout in. That would be Miami-Dade, Broward, of course, always is one. Then you have the Orlando area and Duval County around Jacksonville. So those are all the kind of areas where a minority candidate is going to do fairly well, do better than perhaps an Anglo candidate right now. And that's something you have right now on the ticket. You have two Anglo candidates for the Democratic Party with Crist and Nikki Fried. And, they're different, but maybe Tadeo brings a certain, diversity to the ticket, ethnicity, that has a certain appeal for a party that is relying on a very strong ethnic base as its voting ranks. So, while she is starting from, zero, it would seem. I mean, she's been doing interviews. She's been meeting with people, talking to fundraisers, taking those kind of steps so far. I don't know how much, at this point she has promised to her if she were to get in the race. But obviously, if Crist and Fried have raised less than $4 million so far, and they've been in the race for a couple, 3 months now, they're not exactly setting the world on fire either. So that race is still very much up for grabs.
Yeah, it seems like no matter what Democrat gains traction here, they're not going to be extremely well financed. Well, we'll move on to some numbers. Antonio, you want to tell us about yours?
Yeah, gentlemen, I had 78, which stands for 78%, which is the percentage of COVID vaccinated residents in the uber conservative community of the Villages. Remember, gents, that we talked about the Villages last week, and John brought them up as one of the number segments, talking about how the U.S. Census had listed the community as the fastest growing in the U.S. So, we've talked a fair amount about the Villages. But here's the thing. I have in past podcasts pointed out reporting by our teams as well as others that some of the more recalcitrant counties in terms of getting vaccinated and as such taking COVID seriously were those counties that are deep red and that voted for former President Trump by gaping margins. Well, the Villages, which is one of their places, there are a few places in Florida where Trump and MAGA is more popular than the Villages, but with their 78% vax rate, they bucked that trend, and by a long shot. In fact, no county in Florida has a vaccination rate higher than this largely retiree community located between Orlando and Ocala. That being said, it is also true that the counties with the lowest vaccination rates, and I'm talking in the 20% range, are deep red, MAGA loyal Trump counties. And these are some of the counties that public health experts have long worried about because of those low vaccination rates and then the proliferation of the Delta variant. So let me offer this up. Maybe the state should run PSAs in those counties featuring people from the Villages. They certainly have MAGA street cred, and maybe they will be compelling, convincing to their political brethren. Then again, last month at his Alabama rally, Trump himself drew jeers when he told the crowd to get vaccinated. And well, if they don't listen to Trump, well, I'm not sure this crowd will be persuaded by anybody else either. So,
all right. Some more interesting numbers coming out of the Villages. How about you, John? Tell us about your number.
Yeah, Zach, my $4 billion is dollars, and that's the amount of tax revenue that the state took in last year from documentary sales taxes. These are the taxes that are paid when homes are sold. And as many Floridians know, the housing market is crazy in this state. If you let me mix my metaphors here. Well, houses have been selling like hotcakes, it seems like. But that's good for state government's bottom line. And the $4 billion in doc stamp collections is the most that Florida has ever collected in housing taxes since that $4 billion level was reached the only other time. That was 15 years ago in 2006, right prior to the housing collapse. The taxes generated this kind of revenue for the state. That was when, you know, the market was really on fire right before Goldman Sachs went out of business and many other things. But this new figure was released this week in a state government analysis of the Florida economy. And as we record this podcast, the state legislature is preparing to adopt a new 3-year revenue outlook for the state, which will help with budget preparation when the legislature comes back into session in January. The bottom line is the state has plenty of money right now between federal aid and strong tax collections, like, you know, what we just pointed out here with these documentary taxes flowing into the Treasury. Of course, about 3 out of 4 state tax collections are generated by sales tax. That's where the real money is, but that's been doing good as well. So along with the $4 billion in doc stamp collections, the blazing housing market also is seen in other things. Like another factor that was reported in this analysis is that the median home price in Florida has been breaking records in back-to-back months this summer to where it's now $355,000. Back in June 2006, when we talked about how doc stamps were setting the record then, the median price was what now looks like a bargain. It was about $100,000 less. It was $256,000. So when home sales are booming, you often find that rentals get harder to find and costlier, of course. And that's where a political component of all these numbers plays in. The disparity between the relatively well-off and those struggling in the state during the pandemic is going to be part of any election year campaign narrative in 2022. And these numbers have some good and bad in them, obviously. So, you know, some will frame it as the rhetoric that you're going to hear from candidates. DeSantis is certain to describe himself as the savior of the state's economy, and pointing to housing numbers like this is something that he would say could be proof of that. And his gubernatorial rivalries, whoever it's going to be, as we just went through the Democratic field, they're going to be appealing to those that have been left behind in this housing crunch. And there are a lot of Floridians.
The housing market is just nutty right now. I feel bad for people who are looking for a home. It's a good time to sell, though, if you can find somewhere else to live. My number is 14,886. The Florida Hospital Association reported 14,886 COVID-19 hospitalizations across the state on Wednesday, down from a high of nearly 17,000 at one point last month. The declining hospitalization numbers have some healthcare experts declaring that the state has reached a turning point with the latest COVID-19 surge. Florida Hospital Association President and CEO Mary Mayhew said on MSNBC's Morning Joe this morning that, quote, "Right now, we are seeing very encouraging trends. Our hospitalizations have dropped dramatically." Mayhew noted that Florida saw, quote, "a dramatic increase in hospitalizations over a 7-week period," but said there are signs that we have peaked and are headed in the right direction. Politically, this is great news for Governor Ron DeSantis, who has gambled that he could ride out this latest wave without any new public health mandates or restrictions. Now, Florida has paid a pretty terrible price with a total COVID-19 deaths since the pandemic began approaching 45,000 and likely to climb significantly in the coming weeks. But the pressure on DeSantis will ease if hospitalizations keep going down and his position will continue to strengthen. Whether the price that the state paid was too high is something that voters will decide next year. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production guru, Thomas Cordy, and thanks to all of you for listening. Stay safe. We're out of here.